Let's talk about a man. We'll call him Dr. P, a music teacher, himself a musician of some distinction, in fact of some brilliance. He would listen to the sounds of traffic and compare them to a symphony. And yet Dr. P soon was unable to recognize his students from day to day. Soon he was patting the tops of fire hydrants, mistaking them for the heads of children. He would stare at his bare foot and swear that his shoe was on. And after he went to a doctor to try to find out what was wrong, as he was preparing to leave, he started looking around for his hat, grabbed hold of his wife's head, and tried to lift it off of her torso and put it on his own head. His wife was undaunted. She was used to such things. The doctor who examined Dr. P is Oliver Sacks, and that story is the title story of Oliver Sacks' book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat and Other Clinical Tales, which include the story of Witty Ticky Ray, who was afflicted with Tourette's syndrome, and that's, as I'm told, an excess of nervous energy, which causes involuntary tics, jerks, mannerisms, and occasionally uninhibited remarks. And yet he was able to take advantage of his reflexes to excel as a jazz drummer and a ping pong player. And the story of the twins who were diagnosed as autistic, schizoid, and psychotic, and yet when given a date, this I'm taking it as a true story, when given a date, thousands of years either in the past or the future, they had the ability to say in an instant the day of the week that that date would be. Dr. Sacks is with us. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
First of all, how can someone who I've had a conversation with a good friend of mine who's going into the psychological health sciences, and he says that it's amazing how few people are willing to go into, to enter that, shall we say, darkest and most mysterious sector of healthcare. You had access to a very good education. You were educated at Oxford and UCLA, and you're now a clinical neurologist for the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. You could have gone into probably any other aspect of health sciences and probably had an easier time as far as hours and days and the methodical ways of your career, and yet you chose neurology. Why?
I think I've almost always thought of it as the most fascinating interface between body and mind and mechanism in life and biology and biography. It may be slightly inherited because both my parents trained as neurologists.
Really?
Although subsequently one went into general practice and one into surgery. But I find it endlessly fascinating and challenging to see how disorders of the brain and the nervous system can change a person's inner world. I want to try and understand these changes and try and imagine the almost unimaginable worlds they do get into. And I think this sort of imagining may be necessary sometimes to help them negotiate it.
In fact, in your book, a wonderful passage, you write, my work, my life is all with the sick, but the sick and their sickness drives me to thoughts which perhaps I might otherwise not have. And then you quote Nietzsche, as for sickness, are we not almost tempted to ask whether we could get along without it? Why do you suppose so few people are willing to go into the study of these afflictions that, of course, through centuries have been considered everything from odd to psychotic?
Well, I think there's, in a way, no shortage of doctors who become neurologists. But they, to some extent, may increasingly equate neurology with neuroscience and, so to speak, with looking at the hardware and the software of the nervous system. And indeed, it's essential to do that. But, of course, there's always a person there as well with a predicament and a plight and a world and a plea. And I think there's a danger of neurology getting too high-tech. And for me, I'm although it frightens me as well, I like to sort of to see how it is for people in strange extremities, and they always, I always say this could be me, and I'm more and more impressed by not only the states which people can get into, but the extraordinary adaptations and adjustments they make.
You also have a rather unusual way of dealing with these people. We were talking about Dr. P, the man who mistook his wife for a hat. Can read the passage there for me, please, how exactly you dealt with him after you examined him.
I find it difficult to read my own stuff because I want to change every sentence. Well, Dr. Sachs, he said to me, you find me an interesting case, I perceive. Can you tell me what you find wrong? Make recommendations? I can't tell you what I find wrong, I replied, but I'll say what I find right. You are a wonderful musician, and music is your life. What I would prescribe, in a case such as yours, is a life which consists entirely of music. Music has been the center. Now make it the whole of your life.
You cringe at the terms dysfunction, deficit, failure, all terms used by clinicians when speaking of a patient's affliction. In fact, if I can find the passage here, there was another passage that
I may deny having written
was,
it.
was particularly interesting. I think it was something about let me look here, because here it is. It's, there is no subject in a narrow case history. Modern case histories allude to the subject in a cursory phrase. A trisomic albino female of 21, which could as well apply to a rat as a human being. You talk about putting the creative – what was the phrase? The romance back into the science. And I believe you alluded to incorporating what was 19th century – a 19th century aspect of examining these things, and that's actually human observation and reaction as opposed to – to clinical laboratory study?
I love reading 19th century medicine and science, and it has a sort of warmth and vividness and richness which I think have largely disappeared from contemporary clinical writing. One senses the closeness of doctor and patient, and also the closeness of case history to sometimes to narrative and to novel. I also think this sort of description can be marvelously accurate, and an accurate description of phenomena can never become obsolete. I think the best book on migraine ever written was probably written in the 1860s, at least in terms of description. But the question is how to preserve this sort of dialogue and leisure and humor and romance and combine it with high tech.
In the laboratory as well as in the writings, you point out and emphasize that with every affliction, the people in your stories have a gift. And I think I recall a reference to talking about in regard to brain damage, when the brain is damaged to cause an affliction, it may physiologically compensate in some other area, and this may be the reason why we see what you have written?
Yes. Well, I certainly it's not one should never just look at diseases or disorders, but how it is for the whole person. And a person is always struggling to survive and to manage some way or another. One knows that the blind are said to have preternaturally good hearing and touch. Actually, their powers of hearing and touch are no better than normal, but they're used much better. They're used to the limit.
So did I misinterpret something then? Or I'll ask you again. Is there – in fact, you were putting it in the context of damage to, say, the right brain, which is control of I suppose, not necessarily function, but more emotion and perception. If the right brain, if an aspect of the right brain is damaged to impair a function, is there something physiologically or psychologically that the brain does to compensate for that, overcompensate for that?
Well, in the case of Dr. P, for example, who couldn't recognize a face as a face, and he would focus in on certain features. When he looked at me, he wasn't quite looking at me. He looked at my glasses and my beard. Thereafter, Sachs was sort of flagged glasses and beard. He could remember schemata and geometric shapes. And to some extent, he had to make an analysis and then use this to identify things and people. In this way, if you want, he was using left brain function to make up for some defects which he had in right brain function because he had a tumor in his right visual cortex.
So it isn't that the brain was actually producing any kind of compensation physiologically, but he was, because of a damage in right brain, he was better able to use or overcompensate with a given function in his left brain.
Yes, but things may sort of hypertrophy. One certainly wonders whether with the idiot savant, so-called, I describe some cases here where one ability may be absolutely extraordinary and the other one's very, very feeble.
Such as with the twins.
Such as with the twins where there was a strange power with numbers, or with Jose, who could hardly speak and maybe not understand sounds too well, but who drew like an angel. And sometimes I think one power, the one power which is there, can get stronger and stronger.
You approach your approach to handling patients with neurological afflictions is, I suppose, can be somewhat unsettling to those clinical laboratory researchers working in the fast lane of high-tech progress. You call for, as we said, the incorporation of the 19th century approach.
I feel a need to say that I have nothing against high-tech. I use it whenever I can. But I also feel it's often not sufficient. Incidentally, with Dr. P, his compensation, in a way, for the visual chaos mm-hmm. in which he lived, and the inability to organize himself visually, was to organize himself musically, to set various activities to tunes, to score the world musically, and to a considerable extent, he could make up for his visual deficits with music. Now, he wasn't conscious of the visual deficits. And this is why I said to him, I can't tell you what's wrong. I mean, I could have told him. I could have said, you have a problem in your visual association cortex and you have a visual agnosia and prosopagnosia and it won't get better. But that wouldn't have helped. What I did tell him was what he was already doing, namely reorganizing things in musical terms.
This and I ask you again, is this unsettling to the standard clinicians which you confront or confront you?
it may be sometimes, but I think we're sort of complementary to each other. You mentioned Tourette's, when there are these violent convulsive movements and sudden accelerations. Now, there are certainly medications which alter the state of the brain, which has been overexcited with dopamine, a transmitter. I've nothing against the use of medications, and I did use medication with this patient, mm-hmm. Wititiki Ray, whom I describe.
Right. In fact, apparently you didn't give him enough for, or he, as I recall, he came back to you and said so much for your blankety-blank medication because it didn't work.
As in an opposite situation with people with Parkinson's disease or profound sleeping sickness who don't have enough dopamine in their brain, one gives them L-DOPA, is a precursor. But all I'm saying is that the chemistry may not be enough. And for example, with the patients I described in awakenings who had been immobilized for decades, when they came to, it wasn't just sufficient to be animated by L-DOPA. There had to be a life to lead, and a life with meaning and feeling and sense.
Let's follow through with what you're saying. You mentioned before that you have no arguments or problems with high tech. As a matter of fact, you allude to the relationship between psychology and neurology. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you describe as neurological science progresses more, the unanswered questions of psychology and even society could become clearer. Now, this is my interpretation of what you were writing. Do you feel that's the case? As we learn more about the workings of the brain, we can begin to answer the questions that for ages have and continue to stump the psychologists?
Well, I think there are all sorts of psychological and, if you want, philosophical questions which, if they can't be answered, can at least be looked at in the clinic. I often have fantasies of calling in Hume or Kant as a sort of consultant and say, you know, here, you know, Emmanuel, what do you think of this? You know, you say this should happen. And I find myself calling some diseases Humean diseases, because they're rather like Hume's description of human nature. It's Spinoza meditates as to how far we could be determined by the organic. And I think we don't know this. And undoubtedly it goes both ways. We're determined by our brains, but we determine our brains. Hmm. And everything seems to me this interface between the physiological and the personal. I'm equally interested in both.
You are. I want to go out on a limb. We have just a very small amount of time left, and this is going to be a bombshell of a question. But let's follow through with this, and that is, could it be possible that every nuance of our psychological being, our social being, even our spiritual being is ultimately the result of neurological functions? In other words, our sense of spirituality, of social interaction, of aesthetics is ultimately just the result of chemicals and electricity in the brain.
Our spiritual and aesthetic and religious sense is clearly a reality. I'm sure it couldn't exist in any disembodied way. But I think what we have to do is perhaps to find levels of physiology which begin to go with it. I mean, one would love to do a neurological study of a Mozart, and one which would not be at all reductive. One wants to do neurological studies of genius. And, of course, people don't come along to doctors and complain of genius. And so this most fascinating thing is still untouched.
We're talking with Oliver Sacks, the author of The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat and Other Clinical Tales. I am told that you are going to read tonight from portions of your book at Elliott Bay Books.
Uh-huh.
What time tonight? Sometime? You don't know.
I think about 7. I've forgotten
eight. Steve Scher, our producer, says 8 o'clock is the time that we're going to be. If you're interested in hearing portions of The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, read by its author, Dr. Oliver Sacks, then be at Elliott Bay Books tonight at 8 o'clock. This book is being read, last I looked, in the Seattle Times, the Northwest bestsellers. It was right up there among the top, if not on top. And thank you so much for coming to our city and sharing with us your philosophy and your stories. From The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure.
You're listening to Seattle Afternoon on nearly 95 FM KUOW.